I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The acclaimed and best-selling author Andrew Piper joins me again. His previous books, all critically lauded, include Lost Girls, The Trade Mission, The Wildfire Season, and a short story collection, Kiss Me. His new book, his sixth, is already selling well. It's an engrossing book that I could only read in daylight hours. I get all fraidy scared easily. Here's Andrew Piper from the last time he was on the program. This is from September 2008, when he was talking about his previous book, The Killing Circle.
But eventually, soon, I'm going to have to clear the deck of all that stuff because I want to get fully involved in the next book.
And may I ask what the next book will be about?
Yeah, it's totally different again, but it's the premise is a haunted house story for grown-ups, or at least a haunted house story without ghosts. I grew up in a smallish town, and we had, as I think most small towns, a house that was abandoned that everyone made up stories about. And so it's an adult story of adults revisiting their childhood and the things that may or may not have happened in a haunted house.
It's a really good book about the childhood friendship of four boys who grow up in rural Ontario, connected by a dark, sinister past. The past comes back to haunt them some 20 years later, and it's and tremendously well in this book, The Guardians. Other than being a really good thriller, is profound when talking about life and death, growing older, Parkinson's disease, murder, friendship, and importantly, the male friendship variety that's rarely discussed in fiction or elsewhere. The Guardians is published by Doubleday. The website for more is at andrewpiper.com. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Andrew Piper. Good morning, Mr. Piper.
Good morning, Joe. Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And thanks for suffering through that clip. That's the first time I've ever done that on the program.
I was very nervous because I thought, am I going to say something that was not remotely borne out to be true?
Yeah. Hey, the book hadn't changed, has it? Or has it?
Not substantially, I think, from that time. I was probably in 2008 well on my way into the project. But having said that, and I'm a big outliner too, so I'm big on making plans in advance when it comes to writing novels, but still you can get deviated from the plan quite easily. So it's interesting how that now 2.5-year-old description of the book pretty much nails it.
And you were turning 40 at the time, right?
Yes, I was going through. I'm 42 now, so yes, I was hitting the big 40 at that time, and that informs the novel in ways that actually became enlarged as I moved through the book. I think when I think of the Guardians now, I mean, probably for readers, they will probably initially recognize the haunted house aspects, the scary, suspenseful ghost story aspects, which of course it is at heart. But for me, what became increasingly of interest and maybe personal interest, because it reflected on my own life, my own friendships, my own longtime male friends, and it became more of a autobiographical in a way, and more of a sort of a gift to these friends who have been with me for so long.
You see the movie Greenberg? Have you seen that?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of touches on that aspect of it. I don't know if you see the similarity. I sort of, when I read the book, that's what I thought of.
Oh, it's interesting because in Greenberg, of course, it's about this guy who, among his other problems, so he's a guy in his probably, I guess, early 40s or however they cast him, late 30s. It's Ben Stiller.
Yeah.
And he just either refuses to grow up or is having trouble growing up. And I think that, I know a lot of guys who are my age who are just having a really tough time making that transition from, studenthood, being, more or less single, dating, living in a bachelor apartment, moving on to not necessarily marriage and children, but just whatever that next stage is. And I think I think that's a curiously male trait of believing that you can stop time, believing that you can put the whole world on pause while you get organized, while you sort yourself out. And then you'll press play when you're ready to, jump into the world fully accomplished and polished and ready to go. And of course, time doesn't work that way. And yet, so you see these guys kind of drifting around in this netherworld. And I don't think you see women do that in the same way at all. It's curiously male.
And the friendship part of it is the friendship that males share is awfully different in it.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I in a way, I think one of the seeds of the Guardians was my observations of my wife and her friendships with her longtime female friends. And I would see her, you know, as she was going through the big life changes of being a mother and you know, getting married and moving into her 30s, whatever the emotional preoccupation of the moment was, or the anxiety, she would share it with her friends and share it very openly, honestly, and she would get open and honest answers and dialogue back from her female friends. And I would watch this enviously because, you know, guys just don't do that. They share and they can be intimate, but they do it in a very roundabout way. They do it by talking about how the Canucks are doing, or you know, or politics, or often unrelated topics to what really is at the front of your mind, which is, you know, whatever. I'm having terrible fears about this or that or the other thing, and I think that, you know, male friendship is characterized by secrets, and we keep secrets. You know, the best male friends are those who, you know, we know, I know what you know, and you know what I know, and I'll never tell. And whereas women, I think, are just more naturally disclosers.
Yeah, page 17, there's something profound in the book about guys and friendship. I pulled the quote, "While a man can accumulate any number of acquaintances over his life, his only true friends are the ones he makes in youth." And that is really true. Your wife's friends, are they ones that are from childhood, like yours?
Some, yes. Some go back that far. In fact, yes, a good number of them. And then there's another strong vintage from university days. And I think men and women maybe on that particular point do share, you know, they do share that aspect of those really true, you really know me friendships go back that far. And I think, you know, having worked on the novel, I sort of thought about why. Why is that? Why are the friends one makes later in life, while perhaps very close, are never as close as the friends we make in childhood? And I think, you know, as children, and by children I mean, you know, basically up to 20, you know, acting like idiots, we're kind of naked. You know, we haven't yet perfected the art of mask and of the, you know, the very carefully orchestrated dance that is adult life. You know, the putting on of faces and being not someone else, being yourself, but a kind of a an actorly version. And as children, we are just awkwardly, awfully ourselves. And when you see someone going through that just as you are, you never shake it. You just know. I know. I've seen you at your naked worst as kids, and there's nothing more honest than that.
Now, you dedicate the book to eight people. The last three, I guess we know who they are: your wife and two children.
Mm-hmm.
The first five: Jeff, Larry, Mike, Robin, and Alan. They're your guardians, right?
Yeah, they are. You know that, and the four main characters in the novel are not modeled on them in a, you know, in a particular way, but they are inspired certainly by those guys, who are guys that I grew up with. I was in a band with in high school, played hockey with, and I'm still friends with. And even though we've all, you know, our lives have gone in very different directions, it's not like we all live in the same neighborhood or have the same kind of jobs at all. And yet, when, you know, when I see them, it's always a wonderful, drunken, foolish occasion where we carry secrets.
Anything as dark as the ones in the book?
No, we didn't bury our music teacher in the cellar of the haunted house. Nothing like that. But, you know, I think it's...
And if you did, you wouldn't tell, would you?
No, oh God, no. Yeah. I think I'll have to check the statute of limitations on that. There probably isn't one.
Yeah.
I should watch myself. No, there'd be secrets of the more, you know, benign kind. We got into trouble, but milder versions of trouble. It's more, you know, just the foolish, you know, the trying on of different selves that we do in our teens, you know, the whether it's a haircut or a fashion or a certain pose or those very embarrassing things. I mean, I don't think anyone's gone through their teen years without profound embarrassment. And those are the, you know, I guess that's really the secret. The secrets that they hold are things that I hope they never disclose.
Yeah. You guys grew up in Stratford, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the book is based in Grimshaw, which is, I guess, a fictional town.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much like the city that you grew up in, is it?
In many respects, you know, it's definitely a gloomier, more gothic version of Stratford, and yet that kind of is how I remember it. I mean, I had a happy childhood, but, you know, we romanticize our youth, I guess, in one way, and the way I romanticized my youth was sort of seeing, I saw the haunted houses in Stratford, or I imagined them, and that was just the way my imagination worked for whatever reason, and still does, frankly. So, you know, those are long winters, too. There's the Stratford Festival Theater, of course, is in Stratford, and lots of tourists come in the summer, and it's a very sophisticated town and very pretty, and that's what most people think of as Stratford. But when you live there, when you're a teenage boy, and you're awkward and frustrated, and you feel like you want to escape, and the winters are long, you see a darker heart. And I think that's true of every community. You know, no matter how well or wealthy or how well it presents itself, every community has its haunted house. Where by haunted house I mean, you know, the darker knowledge of what goes on, and or its dark secrets, or its dark past, and we build a haunted house, figuratively speaking, to house those darker memories.
No, in the book, three of the four boys leave; the one stays.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, did you have to leave Stratford?
I knew that there was a world out there I wanted to come in contact with. I see now certainly the appeal of a smaller town. You know, you can buy I live in downtown Toronto and bought a house for our enlarging family last year. And, you know, I would love the idea of having a four-bedroom home for a third of what I paid.
Yeah.
So there's enormous economic as well as lifestyle advantages of a small town. But I always knew, I think, that I wanted to get out and to go other places, and I don't think I ever had, while I aspired to, you know, to practice arts, you know, I was always writing and I was in a band and doing that stuff. I never really thought, oh, I'm going to do that for a living. I think I was practical minded enough to know that I would probably have to have some kind of day job, which has turned out happily not to be true. But I knew that any of that stuff, whether it was the real job or whether it was pursuing something in the arts, would, you know, more or less require my going to a big city. I didn't know which one that would be. I had, you know, probably at that time, I was a real Anglophile. I thought, oh, no, I'm going to move to London and be a, you know, be Bono. that didn't work out.
Yeah. The other five, have they left? Have they stayed?
A mix. Actually, you know, a couple have left and returned. A couple of them are very successful restaurateurs in Stratford, a restaurant called Pazzo, where actually my wife and I had our wedding. And so one guy up until very recently worked at the Toronto Film Festival. So they've all had quite different careers. But now that you ask, actually, now all but me have returned to Stratford.
See, that's the one thing that I was thinking about in the book, whether I could relate to it. You know, is it a rural thing, do you think? Because I've grown up in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any desire to leave it. In the book, all of them seem to want to leave Grimshaw.
Yeah.
Is that, I think, something that's a rural thing, do you suppose? Or
I think, I think if you look at the, you know, Census Canada trends,
yeah,
and statistics, it's perhaps, unfortunately, the trend is for young people to leave smaller communities and to migrate into the cities. And I think partly that's an economic reality, or at least certainly a perception, that only in cities can you get, you know, high-level, high-paid jobs or pursue more specialized careers, i.e. the arts, only in cities, or almost only in cities. So there's that. But for me, it was less a practical consideration than it was more existential, the awareness of other things. And, you know, for example, Stratford, it was a really wonderful place to grow up, but it wasn't until I went to university at McGill in Montreal, a city I'd never even visited prior to my going to university there, and I went alone there. I didn't have any, coterie of classmates, and it was only at McGill that I almost literally met, you know, my first, first Jewish people, and in any kind of large number, people of color. And we just didn't have them at Stratford. And so to open up your world, at least for me, in growing up in a southern Ontario town, you had to leave to make your world bigger.
That's the other thing I was thinking about, because I grew up in Vancouver, and my parents are Filipino. And the people in the book, and I never think of race as, you know, the race is not the window that I look through things, you mm-hmm. know, but all these guys are white.
Mm-hmm.
Is the experience that's shared in the book, is that something that people like myself would probably not relate to? I mean, I related to almost all of it, but I'm wondering, does that figure in your mind as you're writing it? Who's reading the book?
That's a good question. Yes and no. I think the yes part is, I think of a reader or a reader, someone who's kind of like me, not me, but someone who shares in the broadest sense, a sense of humor and an open mind. And I'm building this story for them, and the test is, will this pass a plausibility test for this person? Someone who, again, isn't totally literal, will accept the possibility, the imaginative possibility of a ghost, say, but at the same time is not going to accept nonsense. I knew that I didn't want the novel's revelation to be, you know, oh, they opened up some door and inside was a ghoulish, you know, monster with teeth that chomped people's heads off or something. That I knew I didn't want it to go into that world. I wanted the ghost to be psychological. But on the other hand, that person, this kind of ideal reader, is not specific. So that person doesn't have, when I think of that person now, it kind of, even as I think of this person, they morph between male and female and white and otherwise. And so it's a non-racial, non-gendered, just a brain, I guess, an imagination that will, if I do my job right, will inhabit the book.
I can't remember where this is in the book. I should have pulled the quote. I'm paraphrasing now. Someone in the book says that if your head's on right, like if you're not crazy, essentially, you won't believe in ghosts, that mm-hmm. it's the preserve of those who think differently than, I guess, the rest of us, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's true?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think, and yet, not many of our heads are screwed on right. You know,
no.
I think we've all got a reason to see things that aren't there, if we're, you know, honest enough with ourselves. And that's why, you know, the haunted house, or the so-called haunted house, the Thurman House in The Guardians, it was important to me that it be architecturally unremarkable, that it's just a house like other houses on this residential street in this small town. What's remarkable about it, though, is that it's empty, and it's through its vacancy that the people who enter that house, or the people who look into it through its windows, it's what you imagine, it's what you project into that empty space that draws the ghost, or draws whatever threat or menace that may or may not actually live inside. And that, for me, was important, because it didn't give the house energy. It didn't give the ghost its own self-defining energy. It put the power of ghost-making into the brains, the psychologies of the characters themselves.
It's like a Santa Claus deal. I think we all believe in ghosts at one point, and then we don't, right?
Yeah, or we continue to. You know what? Yeah. What's remarkable, and it's early going yet in you know meeting actual readers of this book. But what's remarkable to me so far is that you can have a room of people of varying ages, the different male and female, and you say or ask, you know, has anyone here seen a ghost? It's remarkable how many hands go up, A, and B, how many of the people you'd least expect to have a story of personal contact with the paranormal, you know, i.e., they're lawyers, they're wearing the nicest suits, they look the most serious, will actually say, well, you know what, I can't explain it, but this happened to me. And how often it's connected in their lives to an emotional moment, where often it's the losing of loss of a loved one, or a transition, a divorce, a moving from one place to another, triggers this quote-unquote paranormal event in their lives. And it's stunning how, talk about secrets, how many of us have our own ghost stories.
Yeah. I'm always interested in movie development, and I understand that a number of your books are being developed into projects.
Mm-hmm.
Is this one? Are you
going
through with this one?
This one is under option with a couple of producers in Los Angeles, and they are deciding on a screenwriter who's going to be attached to the project, and then they're taking it out next month to studio. So it's, you know, early going on that level, but yeah, there's people pounding the pavement for this one too.
I had an author on recently, and they were pretty cavalier about their book going on to becoming a movie.
Mm.
I assume they're enjoying the money a great deal, or got a lot of it. You're also a screenwriter. Do you worry about how your work is adapted? Let's say they take this story and they set it somewhere else, or they change one of the characters to a girl or something like that.
Yeah.
Would you worry about things like that?
I think it would depend. You know, it's interesting. In one case, in my first novel, Lost Girls, I am the screenwriter who's adapting my own book. And it's funny how you, at least in my case, this may not be true of other novelists, but in my case, I found quite easily putting on a different hat, putting on my adapter hat, and making changes to the book, some of them fairly major, quite painlessly, because I just thought, you know, to make a movie is just a different thing than writing a book, and there will always be two different things. And there's good adaptations, of course, and bad ones. But no, I'm not overly protective of the book, because the book is itself. It will live on its own terms, on its own shelf, and a movie is necessarily different. I think, you know, as a moviegoer, I think a lot of the times people complain, oh, I didn't like the movie. Why? Oh, it was different from the book. And I often think it wasn't different enough.
Yeah.
So I'm quite comfortable with the idea of radical changes to the novel, so long as it makes the end product at least arguably coherent.
So to save something for the archive in case you're on again for the next book, are you working on another one now?
I've got to be careful. Yes, I'm embarking on a new project, and unfortunately I'm not as far along in it, so I'll have to be more vague. But it's about a professor of myth and religion, a man who all of his life has studied. He's an expert on faith and mythology and things that people believe, but that he doesn't believe. And so it'll be a story about his coming in contact with entities, with things that are normally associated with the myths of religion, you know, angels and demons, in a literal sense, and about his journey of becoming a believer in things that he always believed to be merely cultural mythologies. That maybe there's something more real to them.
Angels and Demons, that sounds like a good title, Andrew.
Oh, yeah, there's that other guy.
I hesitated, as I said before we started in reading the book, because I don't trust myself during these interviews to not give it away. But I hope I did okay in that regard.
You did fine. I think we've we've merely tantalized and not spoiled.
Yeah, but man, it's a great book, and it's the first book of yours that I've finished. So
that's great.
And it absolutely grabbed me. Congratulations on this, and I'd say good luck, but it's already selling well. It's already at the top of the list, I guess. Best of luck regardless.
Thanks, Joe.
The website's for more, andrewpiper.com. The Guardians is the title of the book. It's published by Doubleday. Andrew Piper on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.